This is Scott Allen from odedecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of Herd and Code. This is being recorded on April 2nd, 2009, and our guest for the evening is Scott Belware. Scott's a product director, designer, developer, and an agile coach with a 20-year career in continuous improvement. And we wanted to have Scott on to talk about BDD. So can you give us the intro to BDD?
I actually don't do BDD. It's not actually a joke, because I had the guy who invented BDD or coined BDD, his name is Dan North. And if you go to Wikipedia and look up BDD, you know, you'll find the article from Dan. And Dan and I had a conversation because I had sort of a different take on what BDD was. So I'd do something different, and Dan very rightly and very diplomatically had a conversation with me about, you know, making sure that I didn't call what I did BDD. And unfortunately, when I first started doing it, I was mistaken, and I called it BDD. And so I really try hard to call what I do context specification. But frankly, I think it's BDD. That's the black warning label on the cigarette case of all of my, work, basically. So BDD to me is what I do. I just don't use the same kind of – I don't have the same ideas about the frameworks, the actual coding frameworks and the actual testing frameworks. And I've got a different perspective on it that I think is, for me, a perspective that goes – further and deeper than what I think most programmers are doing right now with BDD, and I hope this my perspective becomes something that people start to that resonates with people, and they learn to see the value in it. And I've been watching folks in the .NET community at least pick up on what I've been saying. And the crux of the issue for me is we're moving on from TDD, but we're still doing the TDD practices and mechanics in context specification. The most essential rule for me is, in quotes, specify the experience, not the implementation. And how this plays out is we write all of our tests, let's say, to our test-first, of course, because we're still talking about all of this conversation has to be about test-driven development, of course, because it's all test-first, right? But we're changing the terminology, and Dan was right about this. You know, the whole problem with test-driven development is the word test. It always has been. Every time we say test-driven development, people freak out and think it's about testing, and then as soon as we start talking about TDD, the dialogue turns into a conversation about testing, and then we got to say, wait a minute, you're talking about testing. I'm talking about test-driven development. So the stroke of genius I think that Dad North had was to say, let's, you know, stop talking about test and let's start talking about behavior, because we kind of do test-driven development over the behavioral aspect of objects. I guess the little bit of sugar that I'm putting on top of the whole practice is more of a drive towards closing the gap in communications and understanding between programmers and non-programmers. So I have – the way I picked up BDD and the way I did it naturally turned out to be somewhat a little bit different than everybody else was doing it. And when I finally realized this, I realized that everybody else wasn't doing it my way. So I went out and tried to, you know, teach my way a little bit, and I've still been doing that. And I think that there's a lot of value both in classic BDD and in context specification. And I honestly, sincerely hope this takes over for all of the confusion. This new confusion hopefully will distract from the confusion of TDD, and maybe that will succeed in getting us off this test ideology. And I understand I didn't really clarify what BDD is at all, right? But
right.
I think the basics of the whole thing is that we are, in essence, whether you're talking about context specification or you're talking about BDD, we are talking about changing the way we write our specifications or tests so that they're readable by anybody on the team, not just programmers. And this provides us a means to document the system in a way that isn't just lost or isn't just consumable by programmers. And this really forces us to think deeper and deeper about how to communicate to the rest of the people in the, who are interested in our project, where I might write a test that says, you know, when, you know, dividing by zero throws system.math exception. Actually, if it's a unit test, I might say test divide by zero, right? And you might see that in a class. This is the old unit testing pattern. Test divide by zero. That might be a method name. That's a test method. In context specification, we say, you know, when dividing by zero should, and now we have to think about how we're going to communicate this to users. Am I going to say should throw divide by zero exception? Or should I say, in what context is this happening? Is this happening in a user interface controller? Is this happening in a web code behind? Is this happening in a web service? Because in that context, I can observe that, you know, from the user's perspective or from the client's perspective, I can observe different things. So within the context, we have to be really conscious of what we're observing. Yes, it's true that the implementation might throw a math exception, but if I'm in a code behind file and in web forms, I might actually print an error message. So when dividing by zero should tell the user that that's not allowed, as opposed to should throw a math exception. The math exception language is programmer language, and the should not allow is human language, right? So this is kind of, I mean, I'm kind of going around in circles, and hopefully this will gel a little bit of the conversation. You guys can pipe in. But what we're really doing is taking this language that is in, you know, in the unit test, in the programmer mind, in the specification, in the implementation language, and taking that and turning that into human language so that every time that we write a specification or a test, that we can communicate that to somebody who's not a programmer so that we can get more people involved in what we've done in writing this system. Because really what we're doing when we're writing software is building businesses. So we're taking more business. We're taking more of the business concern. And I find that when we do this, we start to rehabilitate programmer autism and start to bring them closer to business. And this has been invaluable, I think, in many, many projects that have taken it on in the past few years. And it sounds kind of fluffy, and it sounds like everything else you've ever heard about alignment and IT alignment and programmers don't know how to talk to business people and all this crap. And this is true. But what I'm finding with this practice and what other people are finding too is that this is actually really helping. For one of the first times in our history, we're finding something that is actually changing the game in the way that we communicate and closing the gap in communications, because we're starting to understand what those communications are made of. And the basic building blocks of communication between programmers and actual human beings is context, and some observations that we can make within context. And when we sit down and describe systems in this way, we have sort of started to observe that it's a very effective way of doing things. And it's also an effective way of doing test-driven development. Was that about 10 minutes of monologue? How's that? Are we done?
I've been kind of digging into this a little bit with some other guys up here at a couple of different jobs that I've been at, and one of the things that I'm finding is that it's really, at first glance, it looks like it's just about naming things, you know.
Yeah.
Divide by zero, you say when trying to divide by zero, and so then you end up in these grammar arguments where you've got the should, you know, do this, and you've got the given this context, when you try to do this action, then this should happen. And I've seen a couple of different kinds of grammars floating around this specification kind of cloud. And the funny thing to me is that I can always tell when a spec has been written in conjunction with like a project owner or a biz person, and when it was just written by a developer. Because there's two things. A, the one written by the developer will end up dealing with a lot of the implementation. And I catch myself doing this a lot too, especially when I'm writing JavaScript tests, because it'll say, you know, when clicking on the cart icon, and then it'll have things like, you know, this element should have this class. And, you know, at that point, you know, you're thinking, you know, why does the business people care what kind of class you're putting on this element or what kind of, you know, decoration you're applying to the UI? And so it's hard to kind of break out of that mindset. And so, and the second thing is that you can talk about how, you know, you've got this grammar, and but there's still code behind that is translating this grammar into action, into things like that. And at some point, it always breaks down, and you have to throw in these kind of programming constructs into there to accurately run the test. You know, so you have to make this call out to a specific, you know, function or a call to get the element by a specific ID instead of just being able to say the cart icon and having it know how to translate the cart icon into that. And so I'm wondering what kind of techniques you have for, you know, or what kind of frameworks maybe, even if you want to get into tooling, for kind of avoiding that trap where you end up with, you know, specifications that deal too much with implementation and versus ones that, you know, just can't avoid dealing with the implementation.
So we have a place to describe the implementation in both styles, in the BDD style and the context specification style. And I think we should probably take 2 seconds to describe what the differences of those are. But we have places to describe the implementation, and we have places to tell a story or recount what the implementation means to business people, right? Look, if I use an instance of TCP pipe, you know, say, you know, some fictitious class, and I tell a business person about, well, you know, in this case, I need to marshal this type across this app to this process domain, and unfortunately, this type is not serializable. You know, I mean, the conversation doesn't mean anything to the business. It means something to the business in the fact that business is now obstructed until we solve this technological problem. But what we really need to be talking to the business about is, what is the business problem that gets in the way here? You know, what we do as programmers, frankly, is try to continue to try to justify our worth by trying to communicate how much we know. And the most value that we have to business people is to stifle it when it comes to every time we want to start talking about implementation details. And the greatest confidence that we can give to business people, especially in a time of crisis, especially in a time of a system failure or a project schedule failure, is to let them know that we understand the business imperatives, that we understand what's at stake, that we're going to be committed to the to getting the problem solved, and starting to talk about implementation details is not going to do it. So we can take that lesson and apply it to the rest of our communications with the rest of the world outside of programming and say, let's commit that to every time that we talk to business people, let's talk to them the way that they need to be. Well, it's not even the way that they need to be talked to. That's sort of a degradation. We should commit to actually being business people, frankly. It's high time that we let go of the mystique of geek culture. Frankly, geek culture is nothing but this gossamer cloud that we try to hide behind, that we try to hide our social incapacity, you know, our inability to get dates, our inability to get rid of our acne, and following on the heels of our acne, our overweightness. It's our inability to be like the people who are paying us to do our work. Now, I know that's harsh, and I said all that stuff to try to paint a very extreme picture so that maybe it'll give us a, you know, a kind of crazy way to talk about this that's like, you know, so opposite ends of the spectrum that maybe it'll get through. The problem that we have here is that when we're writing all of these specifications in the unit tests, these specifications can only be consumed by programmers, but there's a lot of rich data about how the system works that go into our unit tests and our integration tests and our functional tests. If we could write them in a way so that they could be surrounded by metadata that allows for business people to understand what is in these unit tests, then we could actually describe to the business people what our understandings are of the requirements. And that's kind of what all this is kind of turning to. So the given when then that you mention is a grammar. And the other grammar is context specification. And there's a great historical story about how one became the other. But the issue is there's two grammars in BDD. One of them is given when then, and the other one is context specification. And they're both good for different purposes. Now, frankly, I think that the developer community doesn't really understand which is which, and we have this kind of crazy orthodoxy going on in BDD right now that says given when then is for functional testing and context specification is for unit testing. And frankly, I use context specification for just about everything. Functional testing, unit testing, integration testing, all of those things, I use context specification until I run out of steam with it, and then I use given when then. So that probably doesn't understand and doesn't communicate enough understanding for your audience. And I don't really know that we could describe code blocks, you know, in an audio podcast. But there's a I think it's important to understand that we have two ways of doing this, that I don't think the dust has settled yet over when one is valuable versus when the other one is valuable. But I think that you started talking about the discomfort of describing things in the given when then. I might be opportunistically misinterpreting what you said, but let me say this. I find given when then uncomfortable to use. I find it difficult. I have to fuddle around with the grammar a little bit too much. Is that kind of what you were getting at, or am I misinterpreting you?
No, that's about it. I mean, I found that trying to do it with given when then led to lots of things like unless and trying to branch in there. And
maybe that, but maybe that's valuable. Maybe the unless is valuable. Here's the thing, though. So you know what? I'm not good. I'll leave it at this. I'm not good at given when then, and I recognize that. So I try to simplify it a little further, and I try to just do when should, and that's what context specification is, or what you know what I did in spec unit over end unit, where I would do when. Contexts and then a series of observations. When should, or when and a bunch of shoulds. Now, I know this isn't going to make any sense to anybody who doesn't understand what the code looks like, but I tend to agree with you, and I want to chalk it up to the fact that I'm missing these skills for given when then, but I'm also kind of doubtful about given when then. I think it's a little bit too elaborate. I think it's a little bit too... Sometimes I think it's a – well, actually, let me say this. I've used it, and I found good uses for it, but I think it's a little bit too elaborate. It's a little bit too self-indulgent, and I think programmers have a habit of becoming indulgent in technology rather than indulgent in business, and I think that it becomes an obstruction and something that obscures communication, and I don't think that business people actually – communicate in a sentence structure that says, given a savings account with $10, when transferring $10 to a checking account, when the checking account has an, you know, or when transferring $15, when the savings account or the checking account has an overdraft fee of, you know, it kind of goes on too long, and the sentences have a tendency to go on too long, and then they become run-on, and the thoughts become too big.
Lots of ands in them, too. When you, this, and.
Yeah, and so I think that is the essential problem. Now, and interestingly, I don't think that's the problem of given when then or the frameworks. I think it's the problem of the way that we use them and that we could use them much, much more simply. And what I like to do for myself is constrain myself using a much more low-fi, low-tech framework so that I really have to not do that. And I think I do that because I'm really not good with the given, when, then grammar. And I bet that Dan North and Elizabeth are really good at it. And, you know, hopefully I'll grow up and be like them one day. But I'm not. And I kind of – I guess I want programmers to make the transition out of – ridiculous, you know, test last unit testing. I think ridiculous. I know that's a loaded. I'm loading it up there. I'm saying it's ridiculous to do that. Apologies, but I think it is much more difficult to write tests after you write code than it is to write tests before you write code. I want to, you know, hopefully contribute to the transition away from that and away from TDD, where we're not gaining enough value out of it, and into something that is approachable and is immediately a high return on effort. And I find that the context specification grammar is a good gateway drug to everything that comes after it, and maybe that everything includes this other more elaborate given when then syntax. And I really wish we could do this with code. You know, wouldn't it be great if we could have podcasts that had code associated with this, so we could say, you know, and here the cursor points to that example. And it's very difficult for people to understand this, I think. I mean, which of you guys, you know, I've actually looked at behavior driven development tests, or have tried it out on their stuff?
I've been giving it a try, and that's part of the reason that I wanted to have you on to discuss a few things.
Maybe we can start talking about specific examples, and maybe that would clarify, because I think that, you know, this is all dancing about architecture, right?
Right.
Totally, yeah.
Well, there's a couple things that jumped out at BDD for me. And of course, the first thing is a lot of programmers just get obsessed about tools and about frameworks. And to me, the first thing that became apparent was that this really wasn't about frameworks as much as it was about changing the way you think. Mm-hmm. And so one of my first questions was, is there any value in picking a particular framework, or should I just stick with a traditional unit testing tool and change my thinking and get accustomed to it that way?
Well, it's really hard to do any of this stuff in C# at the moment.
Right.
It's much easier to do in Ruby because of the rapid uptake of behavior-driven development tools in Ruby. Simply because Ruby's syntax and flexibility. That said, Aaron Jensen took a look at RSpec and did a really good job trying to port RSpec to C#. Now, it also means that, you know, you've got to put a lot of underscores in your code, but, you know, hopefully with C# 4, we'll get some language level tools where we won't have to do this kind of stuff anymore. So, what was your question?
Well, I was asking, what value would you get picking up something like SpecUnit or MachineSpec or NBehave or one of these frameworks?
Well, it's in right. They're in .NET, right? They're .NET libraries. Let me go back a minute. They're C# C# libraries. They work in Visual Basic, I haven't got a clue.
Sure, but so is NUnit and XUnit and MBUnit. So what do they provide over that?
We've stopped writing tests. Test divide by 0. Test divide by 1. Test divide by 5. We've started really describing the system. When dividing by 0 should not be allowed. So when divide by 0 from a .NET perspective is probably let me hit rollback here for a second. The way we do unit testing traditionally is that, let's say in the most simple scenario, we have a functional class. Maybe it's the person class. And the person class, if we're going to do unit testing, may have a unit test as an associated unit test class. And that unit test class might be called person tests. Okay. What we have found is that when we have one test class per one functional class, we end up with a lot of test methods in that class. And that's fine, because all those methods are in the same class. And the good thing about that is we can find all of our tests, right? The person class has person tests. If you want to find out where the person class is tested, it's pretty simple. Find the person test class and you're off to the races. The downside of this is unit test frameworks like MS test and NUnit and MBUnit have this construct called a setup method. And the setup method is what you would think it is. It's got all the stuff that sets up all of the different conditions that the person and its related objects might need, right? So the challenge is the person class gets more and more elaborate and gets more filled out as the project goes on. The setup method for the test class gets bigger and bigger and bigger. What we found, or what is true and natural, is that there is code in the setup method that applies. Some of the code applies to some of the test methods, and some of the code applies to some other test methods, and it's hard to maintain the setup method because that setup method has code that doesn't apply to every single test method. Do you kind of follow that?
Yep.
So what we've
because it's you're trying to cover two different scenarios or two different contexts.
Two scenarios or maybe three scenarios. Maybe you've got 15 tests for the person class, right?
Right.
And you could have code in the setup that applies to two of those tests and some other code that applies to three other tests. And maybe some chunk of code in the setup method applies to five of those tests. And, you know, another set of code in the setup method applies to five other tests. So when you try to maintain all of this code, it starts to get a little bit crazy. So one of the rules of unit testing or context specification that we've got now is that if ever you have code in the setup method that doesn't pertain to every test in the test class, then you need a new test class. And we end up with many small test classes for one functional class. So the person class may end up with five test classes. And how we differentiate or how we distinguish this is the setup code of person test class has to do, you know, with every test method. Now, if I wrote a line of code in the setup method for person tests that only is used or only affects one of the test methods, that's a new context. And now we start observing all of the different contexts within which a person class or an instance of person is used. A person can be used when placing an order. A person can be used when fulfilling an order. A person can be used when charging credit card charges, right? And here are all of the different contexts within which a person can be used, and they all have different setup code. And now we start breaking out the test class in away from this one gigantic test fixture into many smaller scenarios, scenario-focused test classes. So every test class now starts to represent a specific scenario, and we call those scenarios contexts. So if you break them out into specific scenarios, now you can start naming your test classes. I'm using this person class to charge to the credit card, right? I'm using this person class to fulfill an order. I'm using this person class to add some items to a shopping cart. Now, I'm making this crap up off the top of my head, these aren't real contexts. I'm just trying to say that there are, if you look at a given class in your system, there are different scenarios within which it is used, and your test classes should be written per scenario. And what we've done in the past is to write one test class per one functional class rather than many scenario classes against one functional class in consideration of all of the many scenarios that this one class, one person class, serves. And when we start to write our test classes per scenario, now we start to document the different ways that we use the system. And that's the magic. And if we take those test class names and export them out of the assembly, maybe throw them into a text file, and if you start reading through the different test class names, you start saying, oh, look, person when fulfilling an order. I guess this system fulfills an order. Person when processing a credit card. I guess this system processes credit cards. Person when adding items to a shopping cart. I guess this system adds items to a shopping cart. Now we can start creating documentation right out of the code. Now it starts to get really interesting. Now we start decreasing the amount of effort it takes to communicate with business people. Does that jive? Did I get that across right?
Well, I think so. I mean, it totally jives for me. There's a couple of things that I started to get frustrated with about test-driven development, and one of those things had to do with setup code and the fact that you might have a person class And here you have a test to see what happens to make sure that the person can log into the system. And then a separate test in the same class is to make sure that the person can save the profile. And those contexts, those scenarios are so completely different that there's no way you can share setup code. There's no way you can share anything between those two tests. And at some point, I think when you're working at that level, you really cannot see the forest for the trees because you're so focused on what this person class can do across the whole system that you never take a step back and look at functionality of the system.
So it's interesting. I guess I said earlier at the top of the hour, we spoke about, I made an offhand comment about the autism of programmers. And this has to do, so there's an unofficial or unsubstantiated theory that programmers are high functioning autistics. And this is good and bad. It means that programmers can focus really deeply for a long time. And this is a high value thing, right? We are some of the only people in the world who can sit down and look at code and want to look at code all day long. And when we're done with that all day long, we're going to go home and work on our CodePlex projects all night long. Right?
Right.
The good side about that is that we can focus on code. The bad side about that is it's very difficult to get a programmer to unfocus from code and change their focal depth. So let's say we've got multiple focal depths. Let's say one of those focal depths is code. Let's say another focal depth is business problem or business analyst pain, right? It's very difficult to sit down and write code and then stop and go, does this work for the business person? And then say yes or no, and then go back to the code and continue to change focal depth. So pretend this is a camera and you're talking about focal depth. What is the right focal depth for the scene that I'm working with? And what happens when I change focal depth? And this is what context specification and working through natural language specification does. It exercises the practice of changing focal depth. And I think that programmers need to learn how to do this, because they're the ones who are both in the business and in the code. And I'd love to throw this responsibility onto the business people, but frankly, they don't know code, and we're the only ones who do. And the other side of this is we are so focused on code that even when we come up to talk to the business people, we forget to change focal depth. This is like painting the Sistine Chapel with a ballpoint pen, where you could only put one dot, like pointillism. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Now, pointillism is...
What's the old saying? There are only two real problems in software development, and communication is both of them?
I have no idea what that means, but I'm going to giggle, because otherwise you're going to have laid a golden egg on a podcast, and we all know that we're supposed to laugh when this happens.
That's not the first time I've played it.
No, man, no. So what does that mean? What does that mean? I'm sorry.
Well, so I mean, basically, everything that seems to be wrong with the way that software is currently developed, and I'm not talking about the test driven or whatever, because even if you're writing, even if you're doing test driven, and you're writing your tests first, or you're doing specifications, if you're not communicating with the people that are actually going to be using the system, and or going to be paying you for the system, you end up writing the wrong thing. And all the specifications, all the tests, all the QA people clicking madly away on their computers are not going to help you, not going to verify that you're building the correct system for the end user. They're just going to help you verify that what you're building is functional. And so that's what I mean. It all boils down. Every problem in software development, I'm not talking about the actual act of writing code. I'm talking about the act of creation of a product, it all boils down to communication. And there have been numerous attempts. Extreme programming is the latest. You had Waterfall, you had the Microsoft solutions, you had IEEE, all about, first they thought, if we throw enough documentation at it, everyone will get what we're doing and everyone will understand and agree with what we're building. And they'll all agree that we're building the same thing, and we won't have the four blind men trying to figure out what the elephant is problem. And And, you know, so Extreme Programming said the documentation isn't working, so maybe we just need to talk a little bit more and get things a little bit finer, you know, at a more granular level. And so I'm just wondering, you know, so specification is a good, another way to, you know, help break down those barriers. But really it all boils down to, you know, communication in software development. How can we increase that?
It's all about communication. And you know, God, it hurts me. I physically my heart is in pain to think that we can sit here and have this great conversation at our level, our grandiose, highfalutin level about, oh, it's all about communication. And we know, and you should know this because you've lived through it, and I know it because I've lived through it. When I was, you know, 10 years ago, when I heard the same conversation from other people like you and me, I said, my God, those guys are like living in a cloud city. What the hell are they talking about? So it's about, I agree with you, but the reality of the situation is no matter how important that we find this issue, we have to breach the barrier that makes this issue important. And that's a really hard thing to do.
One thing I think that's cool is you're appealing a little bit to my selfish side, because in addition to communicating with business, which is important, I'm also seeing a lot more kind of in terms of context and in changing the way I'm looking at a problem. I'm getting some selfish benefits as well in design. And I know this is something you talked about recently with Scott Hanselman on Hansel Minutes, but I'm like, for instance, one thing I've struggled with on this in the past is I work a lot on apps where, you know, say for instance, I worked recently on a video app, and like the domain of video is pretty simple. You know, there's not a whole lot of like when overdraft, then this, you know, it's like basically when video plays, you know, and the method names actually match up and that kind of stuff. So you know, I mean, I kind of struggle with like, how does this, you know, like I don't need to explain a complicated domain. But what I'm seeing about what you've described here is that this can help me still in modeling the problem to myself, you know. And just one other thing too, I talked to some people about for subtext, for they were talking about, you know, should we change this to be more behavior driven and stuff, and I'm like, well, you know, this is a blog, like this is not a complex domain, and the people looking at the code are dorks that hack on blog code late at night, like, you know, so what's the point? But
are you calling Microsoft customers dorks? Aren't you a Microsoft employee?
No, there are no Microsoft employees on the call tonight.
Damn it.
Yeah, sorry.
Can we get some? Hold on,
let's ring some up.
Let's see.
Sure, we could find some.
Three of the people on the call are MVPs, so they're basically Microsoft shills.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Yeah, you know what? I have, now that I'm no longer an MVP, I'm free to say that you guys are serious. Sorry for the sine wave tone, folks at home. But the sounds like Doc Siders.
Yes. I don't.
You guys all wear Doc Siders. Every last MVP wears Doc Siders. So look, what was your question?
Well, no, I mean, this was just, I was saying that this is helpful. And like, you've been talking about how we need to communicate with business. And my point was, you know, I don't communicate with business that much these days. I used to work in a big financial company, and this is immediately applicable to what I was doing there. But a lot of the time now I'm writing, you know, I'm spiking on an alpha of Silverlight trying to get some video app running or something, you know, and it's like, and my client is, you know, somebody on the Silverlight team maybe, or you know what I'm saying? So it's like, I don't like the business domain thing is not so much of an issue for me, but what I'm picking up from what you're saying is still thinking in terms of context and specification can change my design.
It can totally change your design. And what we found, what I found and what the teams I worked on have found, and we started doing this, you know, a couple years ago, was that as we started to describe and capture descriptions of our software in these context specification structures, we started to see that we were finding design mistakes in reading the context specification. So if you kind of understand the way context specification works, we really describe the system in natural English language or French language or whatever language you're using, but we describe it in natural language. When dividing by zero is the name of a test class. It's not, you know, math tests. It's when dividing by zero. It's a very small focused test class. And the test method that would be in this class would be, you know, should fail. Not should throw math exception or whatever. Just when dividing by zero is the class name, should fail. So that's the way the thing works. But what happens is when you're really building an actual production system, we started finding that if we started reading through the documentation. So what we do is we open up the test class, the assembly in Reflector, and we start reading through the class names. And all these class names are named with underscores, when underscore dividing underscore by underscore zero. So this kind of gives it a little bit easier way to quickly scan the code, because you're not trying to parse these just gigantic class names with Pascal case. Pascal case is good for something that's got three words, but beyond three words, it's very difficult to quickly read something. So we put underscores instead of Pascal case. And I know this is not a C-sharp way to do things, but it helps when you're doing specification classes, because we're trying to talk English rather than code. So we'd read through these things, and we started noticing that we were finding actual mistakes in the design or mistakes in misinterpretations of the requirements. And the development team started to discover that we were getting benefit out of something that we would thought only would benefit the business people. And this started to change the way that we use this tool and the way we saw it. And we started to see that if we stuck to the program and stuck to trying to capture our understandings, let me change that. If we stuck to try to do context specification, we realized that what we were doing was writing down our understanding of the system at the moment that we wrote the code, which we know is susceptible to error. And if we wrote it in the way that context specification suggests, we were able to read it later from another mindset and find the flaws on the spot. And even one team I worked on started to come in early every morning, and we picked one specification class at random. And we said, let's just read through it and see if we can find flaws. And one out of two times, or one out of 2 days, we would find a flaw right then and there on the spot. It didn't have to go to QA. It didn't have to go to acceptance testing. It didn't have to go to production. We would nail it right there. Now, not only did we get the benefit of nailing it and getting rid of defects right on the spot, we got the benefit of seeing where we made mistakes, and we started learning how we were making mistakes and what kind of design patterns we were using that led us into these mistakes. And frankly, the explosion of knowledge and understanding around just programming got better. And it almost makes no sense. And I know this sounds like Harry Potter, frankly. but if you do it and if you try it, I promise you, you'll find the same thing. And it's just a simple statement of fact. If you think more about what you do will be more thoughtful. and that's what context specification and behavior driven development is all about. It's about and it's what test driven development has always been about. It's about put a little bit of front loading of thought right in front of coding, right in front of implementation, and everything will get 10 times better.
So here's a question. If I back up and I'm thinking about context specification, it feels like I'm entering the system at a very high level. And yes. as the dysfunctional, autistic, overweight programmer, the first thing I'm worried about, if I write a context specification that revolves around the user being able to log into my site, I'm worried about, well, what about tests at the repository level? You know, how do I know that the user repository is even going to function right?
Can you give me an example of a repository test?
Well, off the top of my head, just walking up to the repository and you know, asking it to return users that match a set of credentials, you know, username, password, and maybe you're just testing to make sure that a link expression is going to work correctly against an in-memory collection of users. But,
okay,
you know, there's some value there, perhaps.
So as you get closer and closer and closer to the metal of the system, to the low levels of the system, it becomes increasingly harder to do context specification. And this is the point where it becomes increasingly more important to stick to your guns and really try to describe these aspects of the system in context specification. Because if you don't, what we're saying when we don't do this is we can no longer communicate what we've built back to the people that we're building it for.
Right.
And one of the most amazing things I've seen about context specification, I thought that my business users would only be interested in the descriptions, using context specification to describe user interface or maybe the controller layer or the code behind layer. What I really found was interesting was when they would come back, I would drop the document off or they would pluck the document off the portal and come back to me and have questions about something extremely low level. And because I was able to describe the low level like a logger interaction, mm-hmm. because I was able to describe it in the context of a business scenario, they were able to talk to me about it. Now, they might not have had anything, you know, they might not have opposed my implementation or my assumptions, but they were starting to gain an understanding of how the whole damn thing worked. So we're really called to drive even to the lowest levels of the metal, all the way down to the metal, our language of describing the system using context specification. So if we're talking about a repository, even if I'm pulling up a person instance by ID, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen in that unit test? So you've probably got a presumption about what would happen in that unit test. I've probably got a presumption of what would happen in that unit test. I'm assuming it would talk to, you know, the data access library, right? They would talk to. Now, here's the problem. If we talk about this in terms of link, it gets real complicated real fast.
Sure, sure. I can appreciate that.
So maybe we talk about it in terms of a data access library that's a little bit more profane. Right? Let's mm-hmm. talk about it. Let's talk about it in terms of like in Hibernate. So
right.
when I try to retrieve,
I'm gonna have to beep that out.
the word profane.
Scott, can you just say entity framework?
I'm actually, and as a matter of fact, here's the funny thing. If I actually say those words, there's a small explosive charge embedded in my skull that will actually kill me.
Hey, Scott, can you say framework?
Framework.
And now say entity.
I can't do that even that. So if you have a specification that says, when I want to get a person by its ID, that's really kind of programmer language.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be a relevant specification. It might be a relevant unit test. And that might be the space wherein which we consider stopping context specification and dropping down into the tried and true unit testing. But I don't want to believe that that's the case. I want to believe that I can actually describe the interaction with a repository class. So I want to say, how can I describe this so that a normal human being, not an autistic programmer, can get it? So I would probably say, when retrieving a person. Now, what observation can I make about that? There's not a whole lot to say.
True.
Should retrieve the person. Done. Now, the problem is it's not very elaborate. It's not very glamorous. It's not very shiny. It's not very romantic. When retrieving a person.
Well, yeah, maybe you could say should be see their profile or read their profile or something like that.
When retrieving the person, should retrieve the person from storage. auxiliary storage, should retrieve it from the database, should talk to our person storage. I don't care. But that's all there is to it. The real challenge to programmers when you do like these low-level tests is that the contexts and the specifications become so self-evident that you kind of start to think about them as non-valuable. The trick is that when you start to do this with business people, you start to realize that it is valuable. When retrieving a person should retrieve a person. Well, show that to a business person. They're going to go, what the hell are you saying here? That doesn't make sense. Where are you getting it from? Well, it's like, well, we're getting it from our CRM system. It's like, okay, when retrieving a person should retrieve the person from the CRM. When retrieving a person should retrieve the person from our human resources data warehouse. Maybe that language is valuable to the customer. Right. Okay. So now we start talking about iterative development, where we're talking about iterative language development and iterative description development, where I would go to a user and say, when retrieving a person, should retrieve the person. And the customer would go, that's just kind of stupid. And you're like, yeah, you know, I thought it was stupid too, but I wanted to come to you and say, hey, can you give me a little bit more like a meat around this specification here? And this is where it gets fun and interesting for the users. And the customers, because the customers are going, yeah, I can give you a bit more information. I would like you to write this so that it says when retrieving the person should retrieve it from the from our CRM data warehouse. And you're like, oh, yeah, I should have said that. I knew that. I just didn't see it. The level of interaction between business people and technical people, even when we're talking about really low-level specifications, starts to get interesting because we start to realize that our users actually kind of know a thing or two about our systems infrastructure. They actually kind of know a thing or two about the systems that we've got running on our networks. You know why? Because we're 10 years into this game, 15 years probably for many organizations, and our users actually know that we've got databases and data warehouses and CRM systems and that system over there and this system over here and this kind of storage and that kind of storage. And we start to realize that, wow, you know, they can actually add language to what I understand about my own systems. And it really starts to light up the level of communication, interaction, and really the relationship that we have with these people. Now we're talking about transforming unit testing into something that enriches a relationship with a business person. This really is starting to sound a whole lot like Harry Potter. But frankly, everybody who's done it and everybody who's spent some time and gone through the pain, they've all reported back the same thing. It is making better relationships through better communication, and through this better communication, we're creating better systems. Because we're not getting embroiled in all of this rework that inevitably comes from misunderstanding each other. And that's all there is to it. The whole point of all of this, really, there's no technical reason for this. The whole reason for this is humans and human communication. The wonderful thing that happens as a side effect of doing this is we're still doing test-driven development, we're still making smaller test classes, and our test class implementation is still a superior implementation, all because we're driving on top of the imperatives of human communication. And I frankly don't know how all of this works yet, and what it seems to me even to be magic, frankly, and probably the reason is because I'm not really stopping to give a damn about why this is important or why this is working the way it is. And when we do it correctly, why it's so effective. I don't give a damn. What I really like is the fact that it's really effective and it really has improved my ability to communicate with human beings. And I really like that because, you know what? I've taken that ability to understand other people, and by God, I went to my local cafe tonight and I got a date. And if you do context specification, you will get the girls. You'll get the girls. You'll get a date. And if you don't, I'll give you your money back.
All right. Perfect. So for the people out there who have been doing maybe TDD for a couple years now, and they're ready to make a leap or ready to try to change their thinking because they want to get a date, what would you suggest be the first couple things they do. What should they do next week?
I want to give a shout out to a guy who has challenged us, the Code Better. You know the Code Better community, right? At CodeBetter.com, Brendan Fazier's place, the place where Jeremy Miller and Matt Podwasaki and Glenn Block and Carl and a bunch of guys blog. And so this is the blog site that is the Frontier community. These people showed up on the Mayflower and shot down everything that was opposing it with bamboo guns. So we used to have this other group of guys on Code Better call, and they all moved on and said, you guys suck, you're zealots, we're moving on, we're gonna make our own site. Here's the power of the internet. Here's the power of the .NET framework. These guys said, you know, screw y'all, we don't believe what you believe in. We're gonna build our own community, and they did. They set up an IIS web server, they set up a blog engine built on .NET, and overnight they all moved off to Code Better and moved on to the runtime.net. This, I think, is a beautiful thing because this is social action in action. I don't agree with their reasons for doing it. But the one cool thing I think that has recently happened, in all the arguments that we had when we were still on Code Better, still trying to figure it out, and with all of the arguments that we're having versus me and Jeremy and the gang all talking about, you know, how we did things versus the guys who didn't do it that way, test-driven, it was all about test-driven versus not test-driven. You know, and we really, really tried to explain what we were doing with test-driven. And then the gang, all these, and we were really, you know, we were really like hardcore about it. And the gang, the other gang went off and said, we need to do other things, and we're going to start off the runtime.com. And I love the way, you know, this happened. It stings. I don't appreciate it. But frankly, I like that these guys have enough balls to do it. And for that, I'm you know, infinitely appreciative, because I like people who do things and stand up and do things and have some courage to do it. So a little shout out on this topic. One of the guys, and I'm not claiming this is a victory. One of the guys from the runtime.com who used to be on Code Better is Jay Kimball. And he wrote us an email and said, hey, you know, I think I'm getting it. When I look at BDD, and when I try to do things BDD, I kind of understand what you think about test-driven development. Now, I think we can leave it just at that. I don't know that Jay Kimball is going to do all of the TDD to the extent that we do it, but just the fact that he gets that level of it, I think is beneficial. And I think the problem with test-driven development is it's very easy for people who are born getting it to get it. And that's the problem with test-driven development. The people who are not born getting it, and it's not about like you're born talented. It means you're born with an ability to see into the infrared spectrum, but your problem is you can't even see the color red, you know? Or you can see into the ultraviolet spectrum, but you can't see the other spectrum, the other end of the spectrum at all. That's all it is. We're blue shifted or we're red shifted. And that's what the Microsoft community is. You've either got blue shift or you've got red shift. And what I thought was great about Jay Kimball's comments was that we started to see a sort of normalization about how we can apply this sort of blue shift thinking to the red shift way of working. And now we're starting to talk about interesting things. And now what I'm starting to see is, hey, we actually communicated with somebody who was completely opposed to us. And it might have been that Jay was completely opposed. And I don't know if this is true. It might have been that he was completely opposed to us because we were just talking high-end geek the whole damn time. And we were being so completely self-indulgent about test-driven development that we forgot that everybody else in the universe simply doesn't know what the hell we're talking about. And we're spending so much time so self-congratulatory about the knowledge that this grandiose knowledge that we've acquired about design patterns and the names of design patterns and processes and the names of the processes that we've just forgotten that we're not really saying anything of value to anybody outside of our own circle of friends. And you know what the fact of the matter is it's damn true. We're really not. And that's the danger of knowledge. The more and more you learn to gain knowledge, the more and more rewarding it becomes to have that knowledge. And the more and more and more we start to talk about the knowledge that we've gained, and this starts to become our identity, and that identity starts to become the barrier that holds people who don't have this knowledge at arm's length, even when we don't mean it to be a barrier. So I was really encouraged to see that BDD had at least suggested that even somebody who had said, I'm not going to hang with you guys anymore, might have said, you know what, I might actually get what you might have been talking about. And the most powerful statement that that makes to the guys, for me, back in the day, if I can roll back the time, if the message goes back in time, the gang on Code Bear at the time was, we have to learn to communicate. End of story. And it suggests that no matter how good we think we are at communicating, we are probably fooling ourselves. And any time that we think we're doing a good job at communicating, we should really just make the endeavor to say, you know what we are? We're programmers. We're born to be non-communicative. No matter what I think about how good I am at communicating, let me throw that away and let me assume I'm fooling myself and let me try harder. And the harder and harder and harder we try to communicate, the better and better it gets, because we have become really, really distant from everybody except other programmers. And not other programmers, but other high-end programmers. And all that makes us is completely isolated. And there's no value in us being completely isolated when we believe that our knowledge, you know, myself, K. Scott Allen, Kevin Dente, Scott Kuhn, John Galloway, a bunch of smart guys, there's no value in any knowledge that we get if we remain isolated in this little five-person bubble. The best thing that we can do is to learn how to go native. And to go native, we got to get outside of our luxury apartment buildings.
Cool. Kevin, you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways that I learn best is by looking at code. And I'm wondering if you have anything in mind as really good examples of, you know, applications or projects or, you know, any open source stuff out there that we could start digging into and see how some of the stuff is applied effectively.
No, I don't. And everybody's been asking the same thing for a year, and it's really unfortunate. And what I think we are committed to here in the gang in Austin, and we've got a bunch of good people here, both in the .NET world and in the Java world, we are about to build a new app. And we might screw it up, but we're going to try to build a good app that's a good demonstration of the process of behavior-driven development through context specification. The problem is that context specification captures a moment in time of one team's understanding of the system that they are working on at that moment in time. And if everybody is not involved in all the conversations in the team room, sometimes the specifications make no damn sense. And that becomes challenging. Context specification is really good thing to enable the team that's working on the app, but can be difficult when it's taken outside of that context. But we're going to give it a try. And how we're going to try to do this is with an application that supports a new community effort that we're working on called Ever Better Me, which is a person-to-person mentoring project that we're going to do during the nights of the .NET user groups, where during the user groups, we're going to take in five people with their laptops, with their code, with some of these guys who are the top of the top, who suggested the top of the top. These guys are going to say, I've got a problem, can you solve it? And we're going to sit down and work with these guys one-on-one, build the relationships with the community who want to learn test-driven development, who want to learn agile development and all this stuff and patterns, and we're going to nail it. So what we are going to do is build a website to host the signups. And this website will be available to anybody who wants to do this, and hopefully other cities will do this too, because I think it's a great way to extend, you know, the .NET user group shtick that has become a little bit, you know, sort of stagnant lately, I think. It's just presentations, et cetera. It's not that it's bad, but it's just not going anywhere. So we're going to try to build this context specification-wise and behavior-driven development-wise. We're going to see what happens. And I would like to say that this is going to be – well, here's what I will not say. This is not going to be the best example of context specification or behavior-driven development. This is going to be a good example of people trying to provide an example, and we could fall flat on our faces, but we're going to give it a good shot, and You know, I hope that we provide something of value. And if we don't provide anything of value, then hopefully y'all can come out and see some of the talks that we do at conferences around, you know, the U.S. and Canada and Europe. And if we don't do a good job there, then you know, maybe we can get together for some coffee and talk about it in your city of choice. It's a very difficult thing to just represent in a blog post, let's say, because it really involves the context of a real software development project. And those kind of things are really hard to produce. And even if you wanted to retell the stories of a real software development project, no matter how good you are as a storyteller, you're going to drop some of the context. And the context is the most important thing about this. So as we lose affinity of the context, it becomes harder and harder to do. But, you know, we'll do what we can, and we'll try as hard as we can.
Oh, man. Okay, I got a question. Can I ask a question? Because let me tell you Please. Why I want to ask the question. I went and bought the goal. Because you know, it's important, right? I'm interested in Lean. And actually, I was thinking about this a little bit ago when you were talking about the communication being important. And one thing I have had trouble with is I don't think, like, I hear and I follow on Twitter and I read and people are talking about Kanban and KaizenConf and all this stuff. And it's like, how does all this fit into, you know, like my day-to-day work? And like the goal actually, I think is very interesting. But I'm still kind of wondering, like, it's looking at work as like kind of manufacturing. And I'm like, okay, how is this fitting into, so I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little, like how does Lean actually fit into all this stuff? Is it related?
Yeah, it is. And I don't want to defer responsibility to this question or pretend to overload a highfalutin question that hides my fear of answering your question. I'm not afraid of answering that question. I'm kind of curious about, was there like one or two things that you heard in the goal that resonated?
Yeah. I think definitely the focus on throughput was interesting. I think probably the biggest thing is the title of the book, you know, the goal. And it's like, you know, as I'm looking at my work, it's like, well, I'm not focused. The goal is not writing code. You know, the goal is not meetings. The goal is, you know.
What's the goal?
Well,
do you remember what the goal was?
Oh, gosh. I guess it was to make money for that.
Making money. That was it. Making money. What is the goal? Making money. That's it. And end of story. How do programmers contribute to businesses making money? At what time in American history, where we've had a software development industry, has it ever been more important that programmers contribute to making money? That programmers cease becoming a cost center and start becoming those grown-up people who actually contribute to making money? Now, look, software development is more than likely going to continue to be a cost center for better or for worse. Maybe not, but you know, we can do more. And I think the book, The Goal, says that, you know, the objective is making money. And so if you picked up on throughput, you picked up on what everybody else has picked up on. And as soon as you pick up on throughput, you start picking up on what the academic name is for the methodology that is encapsulated in the book, The Goal, which is the theory of constraints. And the theory of constraints suggests that wherever you have a bottleneck, you'll have an explosive loss of value. Not just a small loss of value, but an explosive loss. So you really need to protect your software development system of people from having bottlenecks. And when we go from there, you know, we start to see things in systems like Lean, which was pioneered by Toyota Motor Company in a economic crisis very similar to the one that we are experiencing right now. Their crisis happened in the 1950s, right? 10 years, 15 years after World War II, but mm-hmm. it happened. And what they had to do was deal with constraints. They didn't have enough money to keep all the people on, so they had to cut. And they cut a third of their workforce. Now, what do you do when you cut a third of your workforce? Well, the rest of the people have to become cross-skilled. The observations that were made after people became cross-skilled was productivity not only increased because fewer people were doing less work, but the work got better because fewer people were doing more work. Not because they were doing more work, but because their level of understanding of each other's work increased. When the developer knows what the tester does, and the tester knows what the developer does, and the tester knows what the deployment guy does, and the developer knows what the analyst and the designer does, the level of throughput goes up because we're not incurring a lot of sort of slack time, kind of the way that you have slack space on a hard drive when you're trying to write like one byte to, you know, a larger, you know, storage unit that is written to hold 16 bytes, but only holds a minimum of 16 bytes. So if you write one byte to it, you get 15 slack bytes. The same sort of crap happens when we do batching and queuing in software development or any production methodology. So if I write a bunch of code and then I shove it over to testing, even an agile development project, if I shove that over to testing, well, that's a bunch of batched code that they're going to sit down and chew on for a while. Meanwhile, you know, I'm writing more code and throwing it their way. And I've got 10 developers and 2 testers. Now you've got a bottleneck, right? So this is kind of what the goal was talking about. Look for the bottlenecks in your system. And wherever you find bottlenecks in your system, you're going to find places that not only are slowdowns, but are causing even exponential growth in slowdowns. So wherever you have a bottleneck, it's not just that you've got a bottleneck. The moment a bottleneck instantiates itself, it will cause exponential deceleration of the software production line. And that's a wake-up call. That's a wake-up call to say, we can't afford bottlenecks. And the thing that creates bottlenecks in software development is rework. And what rework is work that's not acceptable that has to be done over. It also means when you have – we see this most – there's a number of places we see this. In software development, we see it a lot when we deal with testing. So software development is built – I mean, software development is one of the most primitive industries that we have working in the world today. This is kind of a strange thing to say because software is computers, and computers are advanced technology. Fair enough. Computers are advanced technology, and I got a MacBook sitting in front of me, and my God, my MacBook is glorious. Sometimes late at night, I bring it to bed with me, and I watch television shows, and I just want to hug it and then fall asleep. I love my computer. It's a great piece of gear. Don't get me wrong. But I also write software, and my software is not my computer. My software, software development is one of the most primitive industries that we have running today. And the issue with this is we constantly create bottlenecks. We have analysis, then design, then development, then testing, right? And you can see this bottleneck thing a lot in testing. How many, except if you're at Microsoft, who they kind of get this. How many developers you got on your team? 10? Great. How many testers? 3? Great. Bottleneck. How could you have but a bottleneck? So what do testers do? They don't do all their work. What do you get? Rework. What comes of rework? Explosive deceleration of the production line. Explosive deceleration of productivity. And the whole point of all of this is productivity. If you want to talk about throughput, here's another word for throughput. Productivity. Everything to do with product and producing and production, all from that root. And there's nothing that America needs more at this point in time in history than productivity. Not bailouts, but productivity. And frankly, lean and the theory of constraints shows us the way forward to do this. And it means cross-skilling. And it means a real rigorous look at how we do software development, but more specifically, how we stage software development. Development to QA. This has to go away. We have a theory or a term in Lean called quality at the source, which suggests that a software developer has to prove that his software works before he hands it up the line to deployment. Why is this a revolutionary idea? Why is it that a software developer can write code and not even give a good goddamn whether or not it works and hand it off to somebody else who doesn't even know how it's implemented or how it's shaped or what its geometry is or what its characteristics are to then figure out what it does before that person can even figure out how it works or then if it works? That process is so slow that it sucks the productivity right out of the system, right out of the production system. And frankly, if there's 10 developers and 3 testers and the testers have to reverse engineer their understanding of what the thing does before they can figure out even if it works, and there's only 3 of them, you don't get anything done. Not only don't get anything done, the testers are going to open the floodgates and they're going to start releasing defects into the wild. And when defects go into the wild, it means that defects are being built upon as base architecture. Because if the defect is in the wild, some other developer up the line is building another piece of software built on that defect because he was never told that it's wrong, right? The whole damn thing is broken. So what we do with Lean is say quality at the source. You don't get to push your code up the line until you can prove that the thing works exactly the way you said it was, which means engineers are not only responsible for unit tests, they're also responsible for functional tests. And they're also responsible for integrating with the performance test and load test people at the point of development before it's promoted to say that, yes, it satisfies all the criteria that has been asked of me. And the great thing about this is developers get to move on to do something else. If we all just adopt the attitude that says, I will prove that everything that I'm doing, all of the work that I've been asked to do to the criteria and level that I've been asked to do it, I get to move on to some other neat job, as opposed to starting some other neat job and 2 days later getting my old work returned to me, deferring the new job that I just started, bloody, bloody, blah. And then you got like 17 things all up in the air and you're juggling things you just started versus things you thought were already done. And the things you thought were already done are not done. They've been returned to you as rework. And the thing is just sort of spinning its wheels. And the whole point of Lean is don't spin your wheels. Because when you're spinning wheels, it's not just the cost of spinning your wheels. It's the cost of everything else that's not getting done. And it's the cost of everything else that's getting done built upon the defect that you just introduced to everybody else as base architecture. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very thorough answer, and I appreciate that because I was kind of – it's a very interesting book. I recommend it just as an interesting read. But I was having trouble a little bit applying some of it to software development, and that really
– Well, remember the story in The Goal, where the author, Goldratt, talks about this very high-velocity robotic manufacturing machine they had?
Yeah.
And they spent a lot of money buying this machine. And there was one really funny story in the book where the president of the company was going to come and the press was going to take his picture next to this really high-tech, high-velocity production machine. And the plant manager had just realized that that production machine was causing all of the problems. And the reason that that machine was causing all the problems was it was producing the things that it was programmed to build, right? So this machine did one thing and did it well. And it did it at a million miles an hour. And it produced these parts. And it produced so many parts per hour that it generated a mountain of parts that no one was able to use, which is called in accounting inventory, which is a cost, which is a loss. And when they realized this, they realized, wow, our high-velocity production machine automation is creating losses at a velocity that we simply have never seen before in our lives. We have a robot that is capable of reducing the value of our business at a pace that we've never been able to achieve before had it not been for robots. And this was their wake-up call to say, you know, sometimes, just sometimes, sometimes it's valuable to turn off the code generator and do the production line at a constant pace. So don't produce more code than your testers can test. Only produce as much code as your testers can test. And if you're producing more, then stop. Sit on your hands. But better than that, if you're able to stop and then go become a tester, then go join the test team and help them catch up. And now we're talking about something. Now we're talking about something big. Because now we're no longer talking about the dev team and the test team. We're talking about a feature team. I've got to build the new login feature. Let's say you are working on the Java platform and you don't have the, you know, the ASP.NET user account, bloody, whatever it's called. It's K Scott Allen. You know, you're an ASP.NET, you know, teat sucker. You can tell me what whatever the hell that thing is called.
Are you referring to the membership provider?
Membership provider. Thank you. So say you've got to implement one of these from scratch. Well, you know, you don't have devs and then test. You have a thing that needs to be built. You have the ASP.NET membership provider that needs to be built. Maybe you're working on Java and you ain't got one of these. So you got the membership provider. You need to build this. What has to be built to do this? What has to be done? What are the tasks? Well, you got to code it. You got to implement it. And you got to prove that it works. That's not two phases with two separate organizations, dev and test. That's one feature. That feature has to be done, and you have to have this. You have to have the sense of doneness, of security, to say, "Yeah, I'm done." So that means that the people working on this feature both know how to dev and they know how to test, not a developer and a tester, because that produces the slack space. If I dev a little bit and test a little bit, then a developer's waiting. If I dev, then a tester's waiting. That means we start doing test-driven development at the acceptance test level. And maybe one person's writing acceptance tests and the other person's looking at the other person's shoulders saying, oh, I see what the specifications are, because you're expressing them here in the test. So let's write some specifications. Okay, let me go over here and I'll start implementing this up a little bit. And then now you got a person writing acceptance tests and a person writing functional code. And then you got to catch up on the functional code because there's too many acceptance tests and you're outpacing the development. So then the person writing the functional tests or the acceptance test comes over, starts helping out writing the functional code. And you got two people bouncing back and forth between the QC aspect and the implementation aspect. So now we're not even talking about traditional pair programming anymore. We're talking about two people who both know how to do testing and development, right? This is the science fiction of development teams, right? This is the ideal. Maybe we can have this. Fact of the matter is, we can absolutely have this, and we see the qualities and the qualifications and the abilities already on your average agile or extreme programming team. And this is the goal that we need to get to. The goal is we need to achieve the maturity. And maturity comes when we can prove quality at the source. And quality at the source means this piece of software doesn't leave my workbench until I have the confidence that it works. And if all we do is depend on quality testing and quality assurance and SDETs and QA on the other side of the wall, all we'll do is incur waste. We'll incur loss of productivity. Because if those guys find a defect, they're going to bounce it back to me. And if they bounce it back to me, that means I got to stop what I'm doing. I'm working on something else and go back to what I was doing yesterday. And it's a big freaking mess at that point, because now you got source code, version control issues and checkout issues. It's like, you know what I want to do? I want to always be working on the next thing. I want to always be working forward. And in order to work forward, I must assure that everything that leaves my workbench is really and truly done. And if any defect is found, it's only by accident, not by presumption. Does that make kind of sense? I know I'm I'm getting all preachy, and I'm sorry about that, but I feel a little bit passionate about the fact that we in software development really need, you know, we always say that, you know what, manufacturing is not a good analogy for software development, and that's true. But lean is not necessarily a manufacturing methodology. Lean is lean, and lean can be done in manufacturing, and lean can be done in software. Lean can be done in healthcare. Lean can be done in sales, and lean can be done in accounting. Lean can be done in politics and governance. Lean is lean. Let's not presume that because we're doing lean that we're borrowing from manufacturing. We are not borrowing from manufacturing. Lean manufacturing is lean manufacturing, but lean software development is baked from the ground up for software development. And there's a lot that we can gain from this by simply understanding that we have to have quality at the source. And once we adopt that practice, the entire organization has to bend to this need. And it causes great organizational change. But the great thing is it's not random organizational change like a reorg. It's really methodological organizational change. And what we find is these practices like test-driven development and behavior-driven development and continuous integration and extreme programming and all those things, they just fall in line and they start to make more sense. Really, to me, they make more sense than they ever have in the past. And they give me a means to understand how to manage software projects that use extreme programming and even stuff like Scrum. What was your question?
No, that's great. Yeah, I was just asking how you apply lean to software development, and I think that you totally answered it. So thank you.
It's a big answer. It's totally, it's five. It's about five or six books worth of reading, and they all, you know, some of them are from Mary and Tom Papendieck. Some of them are the Eliot Goldratt book, The Goal, and understand reading The Toyota Way by Jeff Lecker, and reading Extreme Toyota, Radical Contradictions book is good, and you know, dig into it. These books are not just cheesy, boring books. These are really, really interesting books about enlightening topics. So, how do you apply lean to software? Just read. Go out and find the books, and they're good. And you know what? You don't have to read them. They're on audible.com. You can download them and stick them on your Zune and listen to them on the drive-in. And learn.
That may have been exactly what I did.
I think I just might do that.
Yep.
Who hasn't? So you read, let me guess, you didn't read The Goal. You listened to The Goal on your drive to work.
Yes. Actually, while jogging, but yes.
So did I. And you know what? So did Dave Larrabee, and so did Raymond Llewellyn, and everybody else that I know. When we say the word read, let's just get it clear, folks. We're not reading anymore. We're listening. You know what? Because when you're jogging, or when you're mowing the lawn, or when you're doing the dishes, or when you're, you know, when you're ignoring the fact that your child is screaming its head off, you want to slide the earphones on and go to a different place. And that place should be good books. And some of those books are actually on audible.com right now. And you can go and you can get The Goal. You can get Lean Thinking. You can get The Toyota Way. You can get Radical Contradictions and a host of other books. And it's a really valuable way to spend time that otherwise would be wasted.
All right, Scott, before we wrap up, is there anything exciting on the horizon for you?
On the horizon, we have a conference called Monospace, which is going to be a celebration of the work done by Miguel de Acasa and Joseph Hill and the gang on building a .NET framework, a cross-platform .NET framework. So you know the Mono project, right? You guys know
absolutely.
This project?
Absolutely. Yep, well, yep. We've had Miguel on.
Great. So this is going to be the third annual Austin Fall Open Space conference and workshops, and it's going to focus on Mono. So this is Mono development, Moonlight development, which is Silverlight on other platforms, maybe even some iPhone development in C#, some Google phone Android development in C#, and lots of good times and lots of guitar playing and lots of good stuff. The last hurrah in the summertime, October in Austin, the third annual Austin conference, all celebrating mono, and this is going to be a great time, and I'll look forward to it. There's been lots of good feedback from people in Redmond and people from local Microsoft saying this is a thing that we need to do, and we're gonna whoop it up about the open source .NET movement.
Do you have a firm date for that?
The firm date is October.
Okay. Well, man, I might just try to make that one.
Would you come?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would y'all come? We're gonna have a room reserved for podcasters. So y'all got to get down here.
Cool. We'll eat deep fried food and stuff. I heard they have deep fried food in Austin.
They do. We got deep fried okra. We got deep fried bites. We got deep fried LMA. Everything that you want.
Hey, y'all. Cool. Have you ever had a deep fried Oreo dipped in butter and wrapped in a bacon bit and then deep fried again? It's really good.
God love deep fried bites. Hansel Minutes, .NET Rocks, and Herding Code. These great damn podcasts. Long live the common language infrastructure. This is a great platform to be on. It goes out more than just on Windows. It goes out on Amazon EC2. It goes out on Rackspace. It goes out on iPhone soon. It's a great place to be. We know a great programming language, and we can do lots of things with it because we're smart people, and we need to just embrace that. And I'm stoked to be a part of this community, and I'll do anything I can to either support it or undermine it. ScottBelware.com.
You can't get any better than that. We should end on that.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, K. Scott Allen.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Herding Code. And I completely forget what else we say at the end.
That's basically it.
Tune in again next week.
Just cover me in SharePoint. I am nothing but love tonight. I got nothing bad to say about nobody, man. So is this where the theme music? Is this?
We just have drums.
I'm a toy boy.
No, da, we don't. Da. You know, the one thing. You know.
All right, that's it. You're off the show.
I pay my taxes and my credit card. But the lovely and talented Mr. Kevin Dente. We'll be back next week, right here, same time, same channel.